Hello, you're listening to Gaze Gaze, in which we're gay and we gaze into media that's by, for, or about ladies who love ladies. And sometimes we talk about other stuff. I'm Erin, and the text is an object. It's going to change perspective based on where you're standing.
And I'm Erin, and the press pays too much attention to writers. People die all over the world every day.
Erin, before we get started, how you doing? It's been a minute.
It's 2022, baby. New year, new me. I've been okay. I feel like I should be asking you that question.
Well, everybody, I had COVID. It was fine. Fortunately, I was vaccinated and boosted. If you haven't gotten your booster yet, this is the sign to get it. I know everybody knows that with Omicron going around, they should be getting their booster, but for real, schedule your appointment if you don't have it. I was fortunate enough to just have 2 days of really mild symptoms, and then I was back on my feet. So
I do find it a little bit funny that I am in New York, and oh my God, knock on wood, please. I haven't gotten COVID. Pray that there's no yet on the end of that sentence. But like the COVID rates in New York were so high, and somehow I escaped.
I know. Thank God, honestly. I'm glad that you managed to get out of that one.
I know. I do also, I want to say that it made me laugh a lot that you, while you had COVID, you sent me that TikTok that was, can't catch a break, but I can catch COVID.
Yeah, I mean, that really is how it has been. Like, I don't think I've talked about this on the podcast, but through November and December, I spent a month on and off in Michigan, partially due to family emergencies. Mm-hmm. And then like literally I got back Monday the 3rd and Tuesday the 4th, I caught COVID from my partner. It was like literally like the second that I get back and I'm like, all right, now I can settle back in at home. Like, again, fortunately, I was not hit that hard by COVID. My partner mm-hmm. had more intensive cold-like symptoms, but also because they're vaccinated, it was mild compared to what it could have been, even though it was still a pretty bad cold and flu-like symptoms, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, everything's okay. It's just been, man, sure can't catch a break, but I can and did catch COVID.
Woof, woof, woof. Yeah, so send lots of love and good feelings to Erin. All right, but yeah, we watched the clouds of Sils Maria. I don't know
Sils Maria, yes.
Sils Maria. All right. It wasn't what I thought, but we're going to talk about it.
It wasn't. Yeah, I'm interested to know how it wasn't what you thought. But before we get into that, why don't I give the overarching summary of what it's about?
Yeah, that sounds great.
This movie was really highly acclaimed, so I'm betting that there are quite a lot of folks listening who have seen it just because of how highly acclaimed it was.
Yeah, it's a part of the Criterion Collection.
Yes, it is. The way that I watched it was actually through a free trial of IFC's movie collection. Criterion, IFC, very highly regarded film in the art scene, for sure. The director is also a pretty prominent new wave French director, too, which we'll talk about him later. I have some things to say.
Yeah. Oh, God. I saw that.
Oy, oy, oy. Okay. Before I give the summary, I want to give a content warning that this episode is going to touch pretty heavily on suicide. There are 3 different suicides and suicide attempts that happen in this film.
Mm-hmm.
The film also really heavily focuses on aging and also on age gap relationships. Those are the big things to watch out for. The Clouds of Sils Maria was released in 2014, written and directed by Olivier Assayas, starring Juliette Binoche, Kristen Stewart, and Chloe Grace Moretz. And Juliette Binoche plays Maria, who is this widely celebrated film and stage actress, and she's been in the business for many years. And she's just kind of at this phase in her career where she's starting to transition out of playing like the sexy lead in action movies, and she's taking on more like refined roles. And she's been traveling around Europe with her assistant Val, who's played by Kristen Stewart, who, by the way, was cast in this like immediately after her Twilight era. Like, yeah, because this movie came out in 2014 and the final Twilight movie, I think, came out in 2012, right?
Wow.
So it really wasn't too long after that. And Val is like this loyal and supportive young woman who has been helping Maria land roles, practice her lines, and also handle her personal affairs. She's very, very implicated in her personal life and is with her like 24/7.
Yeah.
Maria gets the news that the director who got her her breakout role, Wilhelm, has died. When she was 18, Wilhelm had cast Maria in his stage play Mahola Snake as the leading actress Sigrid. And Sigrid is a young woman who is hired by an aging widow, Helena. And Sigrid and Helena start a romantic and sexual relationship, with Helena falling head over heels for Sigrid. Sigrid eventually, like, takes Helena's resources and leaves. And it's a little bit vague about how she does this. But ultimately, like, the heartbroken Helena disappears or dies by suicide at the end of the play.
Mm-hmm.
And at Wilhelm's funeral, Maria meets with this director named Klaus, who really wants to bring Mahola Snake back. And he tells Maria that she's the only one that could possibly play Helena, because Sigrid and Helena are one and the same. Maria says that she couldn't possibly do it because she is still Sigrid today, fierce, independent at the start of her life, doing her own thing. And she doesn't want to accept the fact that she has become Helena in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Klaus tells her that because Helena and Sigrid are one and the same, Sigrid eventually has to become Helena. This is like the main point of the production, that aging is an equalizer, that everybody becomes the same as they age. And Maria begrudgingly agrees that she'll do the production and be Helena. Shortly after this, Val and Maria meet with Rosa, who is Wilhelm's widow. She takes them to see the Mahola Pass, which is this area in the Swiss Alps where the clouds of Seals Maria become stuck between the mountaintops, and they weave in between them kind of like a snake, which led to the play's title, Mahola Snake. Once Rosa and Maria get there, Rosa tells her that Wilhelm discovered that he was terminally ill and decided to end his own life by overdose. And this was pretty shocking to her, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then Rosa leaves, and she and Val are back in their house, chilling out, practicing their lines for the play.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Chloe Grace Moretz is cast as a young actress named Joanne, who is the one who's cast to play Sigrid. She is this young starlet who has an intensive theatrical background, but since entering Hollywood in the film scene, she's just faced controversy after controversy over and over again. I think that you could best describe her as being kind of like a Lindsay Lohan or Miley Cyrus type.
Yeah, I definitely got that vibe.
So Val knows, like, all about Joanne's scandals, and she starts telling Maria about some of them, and Maria also begins to follow Joanne's career, too, before they start rehearsals, and, like, just watching the drama that she's been in, watching interviews with her, etc. So Val and Maria are going on these hikes, and they're practicing Maria's lines over and over. And Maria is having these recurrent emotional breakdowns because she doesn't want to play Helena. She finds Helena's character really disgusting and abhorrent, and she can't stop thinking about how the initial actress that she worked with back when she played Sigrid, how she leaned into playing Helena. Maria had felt disgusted by her age at the time that they were doing the production.
Mm-hmm.
And as she keeps having these breakdowns, she actually tries to back out of the new production. And she calls her lawyer, and he tells her that she cannot back out because of her contract, and she's locked in. The line at this point between Maria and Val and Sigrid and Helena becomes really, really blurry for the viewer. It becomes really difficult for us as viewers to tell whether they're actually having conversations about something or whether they're doing line rehearsal for the upcoming play.
And it seems like even in character, Val sometimes has a difficult time, like, discerning, like, is this a real breakdown or is this just a part of the scene?
Yes, absolutely.
There's this scene in the movie where Maria, she, like, pushes all this stuff off a table, and, like, Val seems, like, very shocked until she, like, looks down at her script and then reads out the scene action of Helena doing that action in the scene, and we realize, oh, that was just her acting. But yeah, the scene opens with Maria, like, angrily going down the staircase and, like, being like, why did you book a trip to Tokyo? Like, what are you doing? And it, like, takes a second for you to mm-hmm. realize that she's talking to Sigrid, not to Val.
And the reason that this becomes more blurry, too, is that you can feel tension between Maria and Val as characters in their actual dialogue, in addition to the tension that is falsified through the line rehearsal, to the point there that, like, we're getting to lines about Helena coping with knowing that she's going to lose Sigrid. And at the same time, we can feel that Val is probably on her way out the door too. Even if she's not booking a flight to Tokyo and preparing to leave Maria in the Swiss Alps, there's just a sense that like the ending is probably coming close for these two women as well.
Yeah.
But eventually Joanne and Maria finally meet in person. Can you hear the train?
I can hear the train. I didn't even know you lived by a train.
Yeah, I live like right by a train. Joanne and Maria finally get the opportunity to meet in person before rehearsal begins. And Joanne's scandals come to a head when tabloids start reporting that she is dating a married man. And her boyfriend wants to let his wife know before the news really makes it wide stream. So he tells his wife and asks for a divorce. And shortly after, his wife attempts suicide right before the production of Mahola Snake is set to begin. And this is obviously a lot of public controversy immediately before the stage play starts.
Yeah. And either like intentionally or unintentionally, though it like really seems like it's intentional, Joanne is kind of egging the tabloids on because she, right after her boyfriend's wife attempts suicide, she invites her boyfriend to come meet her and the director and Maria at a restaurant. And as soon as the director finds out, like, he's like, we can't let the paparazzi like photograph you guys together. And Joanne's like, oh, but he's like already on his way. And then he like arrives at the restaurant and they like can't even avoid it. So
So all of this controversy is going on. Maria goes home. She and Val are still going on hikes and rehearsing her lines. But during one hiking trip on their way to the Mahola Pass, they get into this argument about the play, actually, where they're fighting over whether or not Helena actually dies at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Val insists that she just disappears off screen and anything could happen. You just have to be optimistic and hopeful that, you know, that nothing bad is happening at the end. You could envision whatever ending you'd like. Meanwhile, Maria insists that given the text, it's obvious that Helena kills herself at the end and that the viewers are just spared watching it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Once they actually make it to the Mahola Pass, Maria starts deliberating about whether or not she can see the snake or the clouds through the mountaintops. She's not quite sure if what she's seeing is actually it or if it's something else. But then she looks behind and realizes that Val has left, not just the hike, but the film entirely, presumably proving her point that, you know, it's not that Val just died, but it's that she just quit her job and moved on. Again, if we're staying optimistic. So, and really that is where the film ends, but then we get an extended epilogue afterwards, where Maria is preparing for opening night and she has now leaned into her role and accepted her fate. You know, she's aged up, she has become the Helena, she's no longer the Sigrid. And when a young filmmaker comes to meet with her 5 minutes to curtain on opening night, he actually asks her to be the leading lady in his new science fiction film. And she recommends Joanne for the part. The filmmaker says that he thinks that he was born in the wrong generation and that Joanne has absolutely no appeal because she doesn't have the same like dignity that Maria has, blah, blah, blah. And Maria tells him that she thinks that he's stupid and that he should open his eyes and recognize that Joanne is a highly skilled actress who would be a great fit for the role if only he'd give a younger actress a chance.
Yeah.
And that is where the movie ends.
Man, I didn't think about this earlier, but it's also worth mentioning that part of the reason why Maria feels that Helena kills herself at the end of the play is that the actress who was playing Helena for the play when she was being Sigrid actually ended up ending her life after the performance was finished. And so for her, it's like very real. And also because Helena in the play is going through a divorce and she's also going through a divorce at the time, she like feels the role is like way too real for her. And like, she just like can't do it, even though that she does end up doing it in the end. Oh my God, Len is screaming at me.
Wait, so Helena, I thought that Helena was a widow. She's going through a divorce.
Oh, I guess You know, now there's I can't remember. It's foggy.
I was just going to say, there's a lot about this film that is not explicitly clear, and that's fine. I would say that the biggest themes are about being unable to distinguish between what is acting and what is real life when you are in the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
And also about aging, obviously, and accepting the inevitability of aging.
Yeah. I will say it's funny. There's a point, this was actually pointed out to me in an article that I read about this movie, that as the movie continues, Maria like goes from kind of a more youthful appearance, just in the way that she dresses and the way that her hair is styled, to like a more mature, I guess, way of dressing and styling.
Mm-hmm.
What I actually interpreted that as initially in my watching was like, she just looks more like a lesbian. she gets her hair cut really short. Yeah, she gets her hair cut short and then she's just like dressing kind of casually. I'm like, oh, she just looks gay.
That's Erin. I had the exact same thought. I was like, yeah. She's just leaning into being a lesbian for this role. Right? So she cut her hair short and like blah, blah, blah. The truth of it is that this film has so little to do with lesbian symbolism and imagery and so yeah. much to do with just acting and art, which is fine.
it's not what I wanted.
I know.
I kept really waiting for them to kiss.
I know. There's no kiss. There's, yeah.
Before watching this movie, my partner and I watched The Matrix trilogy and then Resurrections. And what a fucking movie to juxtapose against The Matrix series. It's yeah. just like especially Resurrections, it went from like no subtlety, like I know directors who use subtext and they're all cowards, to like this, and I was just like a complete whiplash.
Yeah, this is all about the subtext.
Yeah. Also, how did the Matrix series and Resurrections end up being gayer than this by like fucking so much?
You want to know why? It's because it was written by gay people.
Yeah, true.
I do not think that Olivier Assayas is queer.
No, for sure. For certain.
I know. Though Olivier Assayas has worked a lot with lesbians.
Yeah.
Or not lesbians, but like queer women.
Queer women, yeah.
Sapphic
Christian
women.
Stewart.
Okay, speaking of Olivier Assayas, let me just share what I know.
I know. Unfortunate.
So he has frequently collaborated with Juliette Binoche, who plays Maria. He's done two other movies with her, and also with Kristen Stewart, because she was in another one of his movies called Personal Shopper. Have you heard of this?
I've heard of it because Kristen Stewart is in it, but I don't know anything about it.
It looks interesting, and I am curious to see it. Basic premise is that Kristen Stewart, she's like a young American woman who is working in Paris as a personal shopper, but at the same time, she's like trying to communicate with her dead twin brother through mediums and stuff.
Yeah.
It sounds interesting, honestly.
That sounds great.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested to watch it at some point. But Olivier Assayas is actually best known for a movie called Irma Vep, which coincidentally, my friend Sammy just recommended to me last night because she watched it this weekend and thought it was really good. And it's like, wow, what a small world. we're both watching the different Olivier Assayas films in the same weekend. But what she had to say about Irma Vep is, and I quote, "It's super self-reflexive and about cinema and how grounded and fantastical it is. The plot is that it's a washed-up French director making a remake of a 1915 silent film series, and he decides that he wants Maggie Cheung to play the iconic lead character Irma Vep. And so Maggie Cheung actually just plays herself in the movie as an actress who is playing the character Irma Vep, and slowly she comes to embody the character more and more off-screen. And there's some really interesting themes about image and reality in film. It's simultaneously showing the behind the scenes of film production and taking that glamour and mystique out of film production. Yet it also argues that there is a certain magic and fantasy to film that is not removable. So it honestly, the reason that we started talking about it was that I told her the plot of this movie and she was like, wow, that sounds really similar to this other movie I just watched.
Oh,
I can't believe that they're by the same guy.
Oh my God. I will say, I haven't heard of this, but I did just like Google image search it. And
she looks great.
She looks great. And B, I was like scrolling down and then it showed this picture of somebody looking in a mirror and they're like in a maid outfit. But then in the mirror is like a werewolf wearing the maid outfit. And
wait, send that to me.
Okay, yeah, I will. It seems to be like a stage adaptation or something.
Yeah, it's like very latex BDSM focused too in terms of its imagery.
Oh, this might be something else actually.
Yeah, Irma Vep is a character.
So yeah.
There's like a character in the movie.
Anyway.
Okay, anyway.
Let's just watch that for the podcast.
No. But I do want to watch Irma Vep at some point. It looks really interesting.
Yeah, totally.
Unfortunate that I might be going on a deep dive of movies by the sky.
Yeah.
And why is it that the fucked up dudes are always making good movies?
Just fucked explain up, it. Fucked up dudes are just everywhere in Hollywood.
That's we are true. Finding and out. This isn't even this Hollywood. Age. He's French.
He's fucking French.
He's like most known for this modern film movement called the New French Extremity, which is like the edge of filmmaking in like the early 2000s in French cinema specifically.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that is notable about Olivier Assayas is that in 2009, he publicly aligned himself with Roman Polanski when he signed a petition in support of his release from prison after Roman Polanski was arrested for drugging and raping a 13-year-old girl. This is also the second episode about an art film where Roman Polanski has come up, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. We talked about him also in our Portrait of a Lady on Fire episode because the director and lead actress from that film actively protested him at the same time that Assayas supported him and signed his release petition.
Ugh.
Assayas also himself met a 17-year-old actress on set and waited until she was 20 to start dating her, which again, very similar to the director of Portrait of a Lady on Fire, who started dating the lead actress of that film after they met when I think she was 15. I can't remember exactly the age. We talked God. About it at length in that episode.
Yeah. Well, and also kind of interesting to note that in this movie, Clouds of Sils Maria, there is a character that Maria specifically doesn't like because she met this man when she was 17 and then he waited yes. until she was 18 to start dating her. And yeah.
I forgot all about, I blocked that out of my memory. And I'm so glad that you brought this up because the way that that's talked about in this movie too is that it's like, she doesn't want to sit next to him when they are at the funeral
mm-hmm.
because she is creeped out by him and had like a horrible interaction with him. But then as soon as she sits down and talks to him, they hit it off and she actually invites him over to her hotel room.
Yeah. It feels bad, man.
Yeah. Feels real bad.
Especially after she talks about all the shitty things that he did to her while she was young and upcoming. And then, yeah, just all is forgiven. I guess I'll sleep with him again. It does feel very influenced by this director's own experiences. Ah!
Yep. He is 65, by the way. He's 66. Sorry. Oh, his birthday is one day before mine.
Oh, no. Well, at least he's not in your cluster.
God. He's not in my sensei cluster. Oh, my God. You're he's so not. Right. Well, I
count your blessings.
God. I do still have Ellen DeGeneres in there, though. So
I know. In your description, you were just talking about how the line between Maria and Val and Sigrid and Helena are totally mm-hmm. blurred. How do you feel about the interpretation that I kept seeing online that was like talking about how those four characters are the same and because Sigrid is Helena, Val is actually Maria and Maria was just imagining Val was there the whole time, like Fight Club style.
I've never seen Fight Club.
Oh shit! I just ruined. I forget what I said then.
Don't worry. I already forgot what you said.
Okay, great. How do you feel about the interpretation that they're all the same? That Val and Maria are the same person, and that's why Val disappeared.
It's fine.
I guess so. I think it's kind of silly.
Can I add another interesting layer to this?
Sure.
I read an interview in Metro that was published in April of 2015, but the interview was done in October of 2014, like right after the movie came out, with Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart. And Kristen Stewart said that her relationship with Binoche was truly just exactly like Maria and Val's was. She said that they didn't have to work to have that dynamic at all. It was completely natural. And
it feels natural too. Yeah.
And actually that it added this extra layer of like, they are actresses playing actresses who are reciting lines. Who is who? What's real? Like, to the point that they couldn't parse it out for themselves when they were in the roles. And Kristen Stewart said, quote, "It's smart that it acknowledges you could never fully step outside of yourself. It's delusional to think that actors are playing other people. It is always you. It's versions of you, but it's going to take a toll. It fills you back up with something else, but at the end of the day, it's taxing."
Yeah. So God, and they do such a good job, because I imagine it would have been really difficult to be somebody reading lines when you're like supposed to be like reading lines.
Yeah.
And like it there's never any like, my suspension of disbelief was never broken at any point. Like, I was always like, these are the characters that I'm watching. It was never like, this is Kristen Stewart, like, playing somebody who's trying to read lines.
Exactly. Same here. I think that the fact that they are so good at it also lends to the whole crux of the film, which is, like, being unable to determine what is real and what isn't. It's because they themselves are carrying it. So that's just another third layer to consider in your question of like, who is really who? Like, at the end of the day, are they also just Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart? Kind of, yeah, you know, like.
Yeah, that's fair. One interpretation that I did really like, in the scene where Val disappears, you know, they're having this argument about like what it means to have Helena disappear, and like, does that mean it's suicide or not? And I think when I was initially watching that scene, I was like, I kind of related a lot to Maria. I was like, oh my God, did something happen? Like, how could Val just like leave Maria in this moment? Like, again, I had the expectation going into this movie that it was going to be less subtextually gay and more overtly gay.
Mm-hmm.
So I was expecting them to at least like share like, I don't know, some small touches or something. And so it wasn't until there's the epilogue. And at the end of the epilogue, Maria goes up to Joanne and is like, hey, at the end of the play, when you walk out on Helena, can you just pause for a moment to give Helena a little bit more attention? And Joanne ends up saying to Maria, no, I'm not going to do that. No one really gives a fuck about Helena at that point, do they? I'm sorry. I mean, it's pretty clear to me that poor woman's all washed up. And Maria ends up like just kind of like being like, okay, all right. And so yeah, I think like those two things like kind of connected for me of, mm-hmm, like Maria might have been really invested in her relationship with Val, but Val was willing to just kind of disappear on her just to prove her point. And like that was like kind of like a all fuck moment for me.
Yes. And it is Val leaving that gives Maria the clarity to see that.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
So it is interesting too that like that simple act of like abandoning somebody to prove a point ultimately completely proved the point for her and put her life like back in a spot where she could accept that like this is where she's at in her stage of life, and
yeah,
that, like, it's fine to be there right now, and she can uplift people like Joanne who are just starting their careers, and that she can use like her good standing to do deeds like that. I don't know.
Right. Because yeah, it can be seen as like really cruel that like Val would just kind of like abandon Maria, mm-hmm, like that. But I mean, the point that she's abandoning her over is like a positive point, because it almost seems like Maria is going in a direction where she feels like she does need to like die to like at the end of this to become, yep, Helena, and just kind of like that's just like her way of life.
With suicide being such a heavy theme, I couldn't help but wonder if it was going to end with Maria's suicide at the end. And I'm, yeah, really glad that it didn't. I'm really glad, yeah, that like Val made the point of like life is what you make it, like
right.
And she's like, okay, I guess you're right.
So. too, yeah, with the I think it's fun too, that this scene was like filmed in to show like the clouds of Sils Maria at that mm-hmm. point and them seeing them become the snake, because again, like depending on where you're standing, like the clouds, they could just look like clouds, or depending on your interpretation, it could look like water or anything else, and you know, people right. call him a snake, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a snake, and it's yeah, all about perspective.
It was like Maria wanted to be able to see Wilhelm's perspective to understand what was going through his mind, because also the other thing is yeah. that he died by suicide watching the snake yeah. woman, and so yeah. she's there, they're having this heavy conversation about suicide, she's there, and Val is gone, and it's like, well, what yeah. is she gonna make of it, like
right yeah good stuff
yeah. For real. Oh, I want to talk a little bit more about the production of this film, too.
Oh, yeah, please. So
one thing that we haven't mentioned is that Chanel actually sponsored this movie. Yes, the brand Chanel provided the wardrobes, they provided the makeup, the jewelry, and they also actually paid Assayas to shoot this film on 35mm film instead of shooting it digitally. Which lended a lot to the aesthetic and look of the movie.
And I like the product placement in the movie. I feel like it actually lends itself to the themes of the film. The scene is like early on where Maria is getting fitted for a Chanel dress in order to wear it to attend what would have been like an award ceremony for the author who died, but is becoming like his... just kind of like more of a somber event. And, you know, her hair is like done up and, you know, she's in a designer dress. Mm-hmm. And that just is juxtaposed to like how she looks at the end of the movie where, you know, her hair is shorter and she has like kind of a more casual and mature clothing look to her. Mm-hmm. Like it just kind of fits well with like the themes of time and aging.
Yes. The other thing, Chanel, like height of luxury and designer brand, iconic for this like new wave French cinema to include stuff about Chanel. I feel like it would be remiss not to mention that Coco Chanel was a Nazi agent.
Yeah, she was.
So just putting that out there too. Also, not everything in the wardrobe was Chanel, specifically because I noted, and I quote, K-Stew is bringing the Lacoste polo back into fashion.
Oh, hell yeah.
She was wearing a Lacoste polo at one point with like the little alligator on it.
Wow.
And she looked good, honestly. I yeah. was like, damn, I forgot that people can look good in polo t-shirts.
God, remember when those were so popular?
Yes, and I'm glad that they're not now.
I don't know. The 2000s fashion's making a comeback. Soon we will be at the Lacoste polo.
The other thing that I really want to talk about that I want to ask your opinion about too, Assayas has said that the play Mahola Snake is supposed to be a condensed and brutalized version of The Bitter Tears of Pedro von Kant by Rainer Werner Fassbinder, which we did an episode on. Episode 17 was our episode on this. I could talk about that film for days. I feel like I feel like I think back on it and have realizations about it all the time.
Right, right, yeah.
There are definitely some parallels here, too. That film, it's a stage play that's been adapted, that was adapted into a movie. It all takes place in, like, one little condensed set that rotates just mm-hmm. like you would see in a stage production. Rainer Werner Fassbinder, like Wilhelm, died of an overdose, though it wasn't suicide. And there are a lot of other parallels. Lesbianism, age gap relationships, suicide, and nihilism.
Yeah, totally.
This almost feels a little bit like, let's take this like horribly brutal nihilistic piece and then try to give like some sort of optimistic view and reading of it.
Though it's a little bit funny because Sigrid is such a conniving kind of character where she's like really riding Helena for all she's worth and like seducing her, and it's very much supposed to be intentional, where in Bitter Tears it always seemed like that this was just something that was kind of happening around this young character. I can't remember the name though.
Karin.
Yeah.
It's like Petra is an older woman who meets a younger woman named Karin, and she mm-hmm. falls head over heels and is like, I will do anything for her. I will get her a job in modeling. I will like wrap my life around her. And then Karin treats her really callously and just like kind of uses her for her connections. and then ultimately leaves her, and Petra like breaks down and is like, this is why humanity is bad, and like blah blah blah. Basically, right? Like, one thing that sticks out to me in this reference in The Clouds of Seals Maria is that like Petra von Kant was a really, really personal work for Fassbinder.
Right, yeah.
He was a bisexual man who admitted that Petra, aka Helena in this film, was a self-insert character that was based on his own life. And I think that in Clouds of Seals Maria, that personal link doesn't feel present at all. Instead, mm-hmm. it's just kind of like, we have a lot of reverence for Rainer Werner Fassbinder's work. Let's go from there, which admittedly, to me, makes it feel a little bit less authentic in its queerness, if just because, again, it's not by a queer person about their queer experience.
I know. And especially when there is a character who, like, has a, like, real-life connection to the director, and that's, like, this guy who was predatory to, like, a young actress. And it's, that feels bad, too.
I know.
I see here that you wrote that critics loved Kay Stew in this.
Yes. And a lot of people said that she completely carried this movie. Honestly, I think all three of the lead actresses really shined in each of their roles. But Kristen Stewart just killed it is the thing.
It's hard to imagine that this was one of the first things that she did after Twilight, because at that point, the media was like so against her. They were like, Kristen Stewart can't act. Like, Bella is like an idiot. Like, there was so much negative press around her, especially with, I think, some of the misogyny that came from the fan base of Twilight, where people didn't like Bella because mm-hmm. they wanted to be Bella.
Exactly. I can't remember exactly where I read it, but the reason that I was interested in watching Clouds of Seals Maria is that Kristen Stewart at some point did this interview where she was like, everybody wants to talk about my, paraphrase of course, where she was like, everybody wants to talk about my participation in Twilight and like my major box office films. I'm trying to think of some, but like Charlie's Angels, Underwater, you know, stuff that she's been doing recently. But she was like, but nobody really wants to talk about like some of the movies that I feel like are my best work, where I acted the best, that are like the best movies to watch, including Clouds of Seals Maria. And I was like, well, shit, if she thinks that this is like one of the best movies she's ever been in, like, I have to go back and watch it to see how she does. She, what I learned is that through the Metro interview that I referenced earlier, is that she was actually initially offered the part of Joanne, which also could have been a good part for her, but she actually asked if she could play Val instead.
That's awesome.
Yeah, she said that she had known parts like Val's part very well, but she had never had the opportunity to be a supporting character to a main lead. And she really wanted to see what she could do in a role like that. And clearly she did fantastic, because she won multiple awards for Best Supporting Actress. And just like killed it and carried this movie. She feels like a super real personal assistant and very like down to earth.
Also, I love Chloe Grace Moretz as Joanne.
Yes, they could not have made a better casting choice with Chloe Grace, honestly.
Absolutely. Because, oh my god, I love her as like conniving type of characters. She was also in 30 Rock, which is a very problematic fave of mine. But yeah, she's like a conniving type character in that as well. And she's just so good at it.
She's so good at it. The other thing is that Chloe Grace Moretz looks so sweet and cute that you get like a little bit of that like pageant girl who has a mean streak in her vibe, which is like infinitely more entertaining to me than like if Kristen Stewart were in that role. And was like, because Kristen Stewart just has such a chill energy to her. She doesn't have that like hyped up, like, again, like party girl energy.
No, I think it would have been a harder sell for Kay Stew in that role.
I completely agree.
Because I would have been like, Kristen Stewart, she's never done anything wrong. That's not true. But thinking of Chloe, there's the scene, Val and Maria, they go to watch Joanne's recent movie, which is like an Avengers type movie.
Talk about scenes that gave me whiplash. When it cut to that, I was like,
I loved it. Joanne is playing a mutant who like betrays the other mutants to side with the villain, and she's like, they're on a spaceship and she's like in this like spandex like shiny space outfit.
It's like very and Fifth Element, honestly.
It's honestly so good. And then afterwards Maria and Val are like talking about the film over drinks, and like Maria's like, that was bad, and Val's like, actually that was good.
Oh my god, yes, their conversation, that's one of the first like early signs where they're starting to have a lot of conflict.
Yeah, yeah.
Is when they disagree over this movie, and like Val is just like, oh my god, I hate you, like you were so wrong about this.
And it's so funny too, because yeah, in that scene Maria, like, she really doesn't seem to appreciate Joanne's acting. Mm-hmm. And her as an actor. And but then when she meets Joanne in person, Joanne is incredibly flattering. Is like, you're the reason I got into stage acting. Like, my parents brought me to see a play of yours. And I was just so in love with it. Oh, no, I saw a movie of yours. And then because I was so in love with you, I wanted to see a play of yours. And that's what inspired me to do stage acting. And then Maria afterwards is like, Oh, wow, Joanne, like, I really see what you were saying before. Like, she seems really cool. And Val, like, just totally calls her out and is like, you're only saying that because they were, like, complimenting you so much.
They, like, flattered you to hell and back, and that's the only reason you like them. Yeah.
Yeah.
So funny.
So good. So good.
Can I backtrack us for 1 second to talk about Petra von Kant?
Oh, yeah, of course.
I wanted to ask if there were scenes in this film that really paralleled for you, or that you noticed while watching and was like, this reads as Petra von Kant, like I can see where the inspiration is coming from.
I would think that like the breakdown scene where Maria like knocks all the stuff off the table and is, yeah, just like so dramatic.
Yes.
I wish I remembered the movie better.
That's
or
okay.
That I rewatched it or something.
For me, there was this one scene where Val is telling Maria all about Joanne's controversies, and Maria is just kind of like, they're drunk, and Maria is just kind of like pacing around the apartment, like, where are my cigarettes, like, blah blah blah, like, and they're having this like back and forth about Val's drama, and that scene to me harkened so back to Bitter Tears. If just because of like, it's a very constricted set that feels incredibly small while you're watching,
yeah,
it, and they're utilizing the space with a lot of very interesting shots at the same time, and their like back and forth discourse reminded me of when Petra and Karin have their first date, and they like have a conversation, and both of them are like, well, I think XYZ, and then Karin will say the exact opposite, and it's like,
yeah,
you can see that there's like absolutely nothing that they agree on at all, right?
Right, yeah.
There was something about that scene where I was like, this feels like it could have been lifted straight from that movie, and I would not have noticed. Like,
totally.
Wait, can I talk about what I thought was the funniest scene in the movie?
Sure, of course.
The movie is almost explicitly silent. Like, almost every single scene is silent. There's, like, no music. There's no score. However, there is one scene where Val is, like, driving up the mountains, and suddenly there's, like, some, like, EDM music or something playing. I can't even remember what it was. And it's, like, all these weird shots where, like, fade in of Kristen Stewart's face while she's driving the car. Zoom, zoom, zoom while she's, like, zipping around the mountain. And then all of a sudden it, like, cuts to Kristen Stewart, like, vomiting on the side of the road.
Yeah.
I had no idea what was going on with that scene. It seemed, like, completely out of left field. And it made me laugh. Like, I was like, what is happening? Like,
it's funny too, because like Val is like, at that point she's gonna go, she took the car to go see like this guy that she's interested in, so they could like party, and then she's like, I'll be back in the morning, basically. And it kind of, you never see her like past the scene where she like throws up. She's just like, when you see her next, she's like kind of passed out in her bed with her pants off. And I was like, did she even make it to the party? I think she did, but I guess that was supposed to be because the roads were so twisty turny that she throws up.
I didn't,
but it doesn't really make sense, honestly.
I wish I understood. And was the music just that's what she was listening to like prepare for the date? Like,
I don't know. There's, have you ever seen the sexist Goodyear tire commercial?
No.
There's,
what is
there's
this?
Yes. Oh my God. There's a Goodyear tire commercial that must be from like the 80s or maybe even the 70s or something, where it's this woman and she's driving a car and there's like, there, she's like all these lights and like turns and she seems to be like really confused and overwhelmed. And then she like gets to the airport and she's picking up her husband and then she gets out of the driver's seat so that he can drive. And then it's like, Goodyear tires, they'll protect your wife who's not good at driving because she's a woman.
Oh my God.
And that's what it really reminded me of more than anything.
Jesus.
Wait, let me see if I can find this. Oh yeah, here it is.
Oh my God, wait, send it to me.
Okay, I'm sending it to you.
This literally feels exactly like...
I know.
You are so right. This like literally feels exactly like the movie. I'm gagged. Straight up gagged. Erin, you're so brilliant. I mean, I'm okay. Amazed that you put this together.
Okay, and so the quote from the Goodyear tire commercial is, these polyglass tires mean more than just durability when your wife has to drive, and then it's like this dramatic music. Anyway,
and it's like flashes of like her driving and it's like, oh, stop sign, oh my God, a turn, like whoa, and she has her eyes like wide open and it's like zooming in on her face. It literally felt like, if you've seen the scene in Clouds of Seals Maria, it felt exactly like that. It's so funny.
Oh my god. Anyway, I think that might be a good place to end it.
I think so too. I don't think we can go anywhere but from there. I think we gotta call it. Okay, what are your final thoughts?
Kristen Stewart's hot.
Kristen Stewart hot. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And also, if anything, this watching this movie after watching the Matrix trilogy, A, really made me want to do the Matrix trilogy for the podcast. And B, also, I was like, what if actually we did the Jupiter Ascending?
Can See, we
do Jupiter Ascending for the podcast?
Is there a lesbian in it? I mean, I know that the Wachowski sisters wrote it. Can we at least make sure that there's like a sapphic woman or non-binary there's person in
the movie? I think the werewolf's non-binary, right?
There's a werewolf in it? All I know is that isn't Eddie Redmayne in it?
Yeah. Isn't he a werewolf?
He's Balaam Abrasax. Channing Tatum's in it? Why is Tuppence Middleton such a familiar name? She was in Sense8. That's what it was. She was Riley.
Oh, dude. Okay, watching The Matrix Resurrections and also I think some of the other Matrix movies, I was like, what? I was like, why do these people look familiar? And then my partner was like, that's because they were in Sense8. And I was like, oh, fuck. Oh, man.
Wait, in The Matrix?
Yeah, yeah. There's Sense8 actors.
Who? You know,
I forget. I think the cop and the Wolfgang.
It wasn't Beiduna.
No, I don't think so. I would have known if it was Beiduna.
I think Beiduna is in Jupiter Ascending.
Yeah. I feel like Jupiter Ascending does have something to do with being non-binary.
It's about being transhuman and about donating your eggs.
It's also about bees. That's something I remember about it. I don't know. Do you want us to do Jupiter Ascending? Please email us at erin@gaysgays.com.
Not for our next episode, but if even a single person writes in and says, please do Jupiter Ascending,
person.
I'll put it on the schedule. I swear, I'll do it.
Or alternatively, if somebody writes in and is like, please don't do Jupiter Ascending, that'll also be taken into account.
Yes, it has to be positive in order for us to do it. So like if one person writes in and says absolutely not,
it's gonna be I'm gonna get an email from Erin Worm Moon being like, I don't want to do Jupiter Ascending.
No, I would do it. It sounds bad. I would do it if it balances out, and if people want us to do Jupiter Ascending, we'll do that, not for the next episode but for the following one. For our next episode, let me look at Trello. Let's see what we could do.
Yeah. I still want to watch Can You Ever Forgive Me?
I want to watch this. Yes.
Oh, sick.
I know about this. Yeah, I want to watch this. I've had this movie recommended to me like so many times. It's just that because the title is so generic, I always forget what it is until the moment I see Marissa McCarthy and I'm like, yes.
Yes. Okay,
so,
cool.
So yeah, I want to watch this.
This is going to be a huge bummer, but yay.
Yeah.
If you have any happy lesbian movie recommendations or TV shows or books, I guess probably not so much TV shows. I think we're looking for some shorter stuff right now.
Yeah, just while I readjust to having a life.
Yeah.
We did some like really long things last year, like with She-Ra and Revolutionary Girl Utena, and I want to do
fucking Sense8.
And Sense8, oh my god. And I want to do some more long stuff this year. I just need like a little bit of a break.
Yeah, I agree. I also want to do some reality TV.
Yeah.
Because that's some easy watching.
That's true. We could do another 90 Day. We could do... I've said it before. I'll say it again. I know you know what I'm going to say. I want to watch The Real L Word, which is...
Oh my god.
Gonna be so bad, but I want to watch it so bad.
Honestly,
we did Tila Tequila. Know? It cannot be worse than that.
That's true. That's so true. Speaking of 90 Day Fiance, what's her face was just hospitalized for farting too much.
I know. Yeah, Steph, that is actually a good update for us to end on. if you've listened to our 90 Day Fiance episode, you heard us talk extensively about Stephanie and Erica's relationship on Before the 90 Days season 4. Stephanie is back for a new season of The Single Life, in which she tries to date another woman who is also named Stephanie, which is the quintessential sapphic experience. And then B, she gets rejected and then immediately is like, what if the problem is just women? What if I just try dating men? And then she messages her like middle school boyfriend and is like, will you end my celibacy, please? it's pretty rough. It's still airing, so that's kind of where they're at right now.
Reality TV, baby. Oh my god.
But she is unhinged, but somewhat normal in the show. But in real life, she started selling her farts in a jar on TikTok for like $1,000 each. And then she was eating all of this like fart-inducing food.
She
was hospitalized for having too much gas, and the doctors told her she had to stop. So now she's just selling NFTs of her farts in a jar, which is just the worst. Like, talk about having a supervillain arc. Like,
I know. Oh my god. I absolutely hate it.
It's really, really bad.
It's exceptionally bad. It's, anyway.
I do want to watch some of the stuff that we've been recommended to, and I know that we've been recommended some television shows, so.
Oh, we should watch Winona Earp.
Yeah, I want to watch that sometime soon. Maybe sometime in the spring. Once we've done a couple of movie episodes and we're ready to get back in the swing of doing like longer form media, I'm down for it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening. If you feel like it, you should follow us on Twitter. We're at GaysGays, where you can tweet at us, send us DMs, send us recommendations, ask us questions, et cetera, et cetera. We've been underutilizing our social media as of late. which again, now that things have calmed down a little bit, hopefully we can correct. But you can also reach us in addition to Twitter by emailing us at erin@gaysgays.com, where if you're trying to get in touch with either of us, you can just address the email to Erin. But if you're trying to get in touch with one of us specifically, I'm Erin Wormmoon.
And I'm Erin Fishwife.
And I believe our offer still stands that if you send us an email, we will send you a mystery attachment. All of my thanks to Kate and Leslie from Neon and Nude for letting us use their songs Lick and Love and Do Pretty Thing for our intro music and our outro music. You should go buy their album at neonandnude.bandcamp.com, though you can also stream it on Spotify too. Next week, Can You Ever Forgive Me? Well, not next week, in 2 weeks, hopefully.
2 weeks, baby. That's all right. We say next week for the podcast all the time.
I know, that's true. but until then, I'm Erin.
And I'm Erin.
And we are gay.
We're gay.
That's all we have to say.
That's it.
Goodbye.
Happy 2022. Woo.
No more COVID.
no more COVID, never again. Knock on wood.
Bye.